what I'm going to talk about is what we're going to do with astro-seasonality and studying the internal properties of stars. Of course, the Sun is just one star, and I'm not going to say anything about what we've learned from the Sun. It's obvious that anything we can do for stars, we can do much, much better for the Sun, because we have much more detailed data. And the reason for moving on and looking at other stars is, of course, that stars are different. So by looking at just one star, we learn a great deal about that star, but we don't learn a lot about what stars look like what they look like when they have different mass, different age, different composition. We know from modeling that can have a very big effect on the internal structure. So there's certain things we can't study by looking at the solar data. And of course, this is the Lyapunov statement, that the goal of all this is to, first of all, find out more about the global properties of stars, masses, radii, so on, things we can't measure very accurately with classical astrophysics, and secondly, more interestingly, to understand the internal structure and evolution. So, and that's something we can only do with astro-seasonality, basically. So the reason we want to do that, the reason I'm somehow thinking this is fascinating, is that we don't really know how to model stars. And we know how to make simple models of stars that may not have too much to do with reality once we look at the details. And they do a pretty good job. I mean, of course, we've all seen the equations that are structure and evolution, but how you put them in the computer and solve them, and how it follows the evolution as the stars' internal composition changes with the conversion of light elements into heavy elements. And all that works fine in the computer, and what comes out looks a bit like real stars, superficially at least, in terms of distribution of stars in open clusters compared to isochrones and all that. We also, and that's becoming increasingly obvious, need to get away from this standard textbook approach that stars are spherically symmetric, non-rotating, etc. patterns. Of course, all stars rotate. And the point is that rotation really probably has a fairly significant effect on the evolution. Not so much from the obvious effect of the centrifugal force, which distorts the star. That's a fairly small effect in most stars. But also because the rotation sets up internal motions in the star, maybe own circulation and instabilities, etc., which cause mixing. And the second thing it does is to transport angular momentum around, which changes the internal rotation profile. So the whole thing is tied together, and there might be layers, as has been in the case of the Sun, around the momentum from stellar surface, which again is uncertain. So, I mean, we don't really have a good theoretical model for any of that. The other thing that actually is a bit more difficult than one might think, what we tend to call the microphysics, the equation of states, I mean, again, the textbook approach, it's probably nice to say that the equation state is an ideal gas. That's not a bad approximation to the first series order approximation, but it's very far from adequate. And once you get beyond that, you get into many body quantum mechanic systems, which are tough. So we need to do better than that. It has the same story, of course. Nuclear reaction rates, again, it's the same story. Nuclear parameters are uncertain. Screening of nuclear reactions is very uncertain. And then we have these transport processes also at the microscopic level, diffusion and settling, etc. And then, as I mentioned already, instabilities and motion from rotation and our instabilities. Convection, of course, is there. We do something to that, which is not right, but it works, sort of. But then there's the question of convection. Air should be unconvective, convectively unstable regions. Something that nobody understands, certainly I don't understand, called semiconvection, which also causes mixing to some level, although who knows how much, and so on. So that is the problem we have. And of course, what we really want to do, I mean, we're all physicists at heart, is to try to understand the physics of all these wonderful things that goes on in stars. And to do that, we need some oscillations that are sensitive to all these things, and then that's where the oscillations, set oscillations come in. Now, what I'm going to talk about today a special class of isolations. And you can say that what we're doing is sort of stepping out slowly from what we understand well, namely the sun, to sun-like isolations, and there are advantages which I'll get back to. What characterizes them is that the mode signs are damped, and the reason they're there is that they're excited stochastically by the turbulence in the convection zone. And convection at a high Mach number approaching 1, creates a lot of noise, and that noise is then resonates with the star and produces the isolations that we see on the surface. And so when I say sun-like, I just refer to these excitation mechanisms. And in fact, any star with a surface convection zone should have isolations like that, so that covers a large part of the LTI diagram. Bless you. This is just illustrated in the LTI diagram, all the places where we see isolating stars, Cepheids, mirror variables, beta Cepheid stars, B stars, and so on, white dwarfs, and pulsates, and what we're talking about here, then the stars really significant outer convection zones on the main sequence and also actually extending up the red giant branch. Although what I'm talking about today are basically the provinces of main sequence stars. We're not moving too far away from the sun. Since I'm an old man, I'm allowed to go back in history. At least I have a history. So I can go back. These isolations in the global sun-like isolations in the sun go back, you could say, to this graph, which is from the Observer's Logbook of George Isaac in Birmingham. And this just shows a measure of the solar average surface rate of velocity and shows a clear isolation. And George has written here P equal to 4.8 minutes. So that's a 5-minute isolation of the sun. Discovered in 1974, on the 21st of March, equinox, more or less, 1974, but then we recognized as really an interesting global phenomenon about 5 years later. In fact, the first time we met Tim is where that happened, at a meeting in Tucson, organized by Henry Hill. So that's really where we started on these global solar oscillations. And very shortly after that, we had power spectra looking like that, where this is the power in the oscillation as a function of frequency in millihertz. 5 minutes is around here. And that clearly shows a large number of very sharply defined peaks in power, each corresponding to an eigenmode of the sun. So that's what we had in the sun 25 years ago, and that's what we have today in our stars. So we're sort of 25 years behind when we get to look at our stars, and I'll certainly get to that. The kind of isolations we see, of course, in the model is easy to calculate isolations. We characterize the isolations by the degree of the surface harmonic that describes what the isolation looks like on the surface. And so in the solar model, these are the isolation frequencies computed, connected with lines. Of course, that doesn't make too much sense because the degree has to be integral, but that's makes for a nice figure. And so then we have our different classes of modes. We have acoustic modes, standing sound waves, which is really what I'm talking about today. And we have internal gravity waves. And of course, in principle, as we observe, as when we compute these modes, we can compute them for any circle harmonic we like, in this case up to 1,000. In the same way, we see a mode with frequencies higher than about 1,000 microhertz, period of 15 minutes, and then we see all the modes at all degrees. So this is what we see are the modes up here. In our stars, at least for the time being, we only see light integrated over disco stars, so what we see are only the low degree modes because for the rest, the signal is averaged out by having positive and negative perturbations at the same time, and so what we see is all these wonderful modes disappearing, and we only see basically zero, which is sort of out here, 1, 2, and 3 in degree. So what can we do with that? Well, we can actually do quite a lot, and the reason that's easy to see, if you look at the voices in terms of saying those, propagating through the style in a very pictorial, which is a nice graphical way of illustrating the Protestants of the other nations. And what happens to a sound wave as it propagates into a star is that it undergoes internal refraction because of the increase in the sound speed. It's refracted away from the vertical, turns around at some and certain points and back towards the surface. This is an open surface which again reflects the wave, and so we get this kind of bouncing wave. That's fine, we can see that some of them don't penetrate very deeply, come back up to the surface very soon. Others penetrate almost to the core of the star and come back a long way away. So they correspond to low degree modes. So modes that we see in stars are the modes that penetrate to the core of the star. And that means that gives us a chance of learning about the core of the star, which of course is a point that's hardest to know anything about. So that's, in a sense, nature's count to us in that respect. Don't have to say too much about that. What we measure are dynamical quantities in the star, and that's pressure, density, and gravitational acceleration, compressibility of the gas, adiabatic experiment. It's what determines the physics of the oscillations. And you can actually, from the equation of stereostructure, get all that out of just having density, because then hydrostatic equilibrium and Poisson's equation, if you like, gives you gravity and pressure, and then you have a compressibility, and then you know all you need to know to get the frequencies out. Or if you have the frequencies, all you can get out from frequencies are density and compressibility or sound speeds. What we have is a great deal in the solar case, where we have a lot of data and do detailed analysis in stars. It's sort of a sophistication which is not very important. Certainly not for this talk. And the second thing that is going to be a little bit important, although I'm not going to say much about it, are the effects of rotation. These are the oscillation patterns that we see with vertical harmonics. They propagate around the equator, so you should think of that as a propagating wave or rotating beach ball. And so if the star self-rotates, the frequency is changed by rotation. If the rotation is in the same direction as the waves are moving, from the stationary observer, it looks like the oscillation is faster, so frequency is higher. And the other way around, you see oscillation moves the other way. And so what you get out of that is a splitting of the frequencies and to lowest order and approximately. You can write that by saying that if you have a frequency of a given degree and as a musical order m, a certain harmonic, given radial order, that is the frequency for zero as a musical order, so for a guy like this, plus m times an average of the rotation rate or rotation angle of velocity. And that average then depends on the structure of the mode, so we can use that to get information about rotation in the stars and tail. Now, how do we see these oscillations? And why were they not discovered before 1974? Of course, oscillations in stars have been known for centuries. And the reason is that the amplitudes of the solar log oscillations are extremely small. We'll talk about velocity amplitudes of the order of 10, 15, 20 centimeters a second at most. So you have to imagine the surface of the star going up like that and down a period of 5 minutes. That's a big guy. And the smallest guy I've seen in the sun are at the level of a few millimeters per second, which I can't do. And the reason we can do that observationally in a larger place like the sun is that these are very high Q oscillators. They have lifetimes of days, weeks, months. So they stand out from the noise if we observe them for long enough. But of course, it also means we have to observe them for long enough, and in the solar case, we observed continuously for 20 years with some of the instruments. The way we observe them, the still oscillations are by looking at the intensity of the star, by looking at the strong suspected lines in the spectrum, that's not so much about that, and all by looking at the relative velocity, the double shift coming from motion of the surface. And in the solar case, you can do anything you like because we have so much light. And so we can look at the power spectrum in intensity obtained from the solar satellite, or in velocity, again from the solar satellite. And of course, the spots are more or less the same because these are the same oscillations observed at the same time, more or less. And some slight differences, you see this peak is smaller than that peak. It's a bit of geometry, but by and large it looks more or less the same. Also, when you look at the background, and you see that the background is much higher in compared with the amplitudes of the nodes in intensity than in velocity. And that is due to Martin's dimension noise. The dimension noise is much smaller than either of these backgrounds. It's due to the solar noise. It's due to the noise phenomena in the solar atmosphere that produce intensity fluctuations or velocity fluctuations at this time scale. And that's convection. Convection in the form of granulation, which again have time scales of the order of 10 minutes. That's not too dramatic in this plot, but here, on a logarithmic scale, we see it extremely clearly. The upper curve here are the intensity observations, and the lower curves are the velocity observations, and in both cases normalized to a maximum oscillation amplitude of 1. So if you like, the signal-to-noise ratio for intensity is here, and the signal-to-noise ratio for velocity is here. So in a sense, velocity is the ultimate tool to observe these oscillations. Of course, up here where we have the high amplitude nodes, we get the same results. But once we try to push down towards lower frequencies, we lose the intensity signal before we lose the velocity signal. So that's important for the design of experiments to observe these oscillations. But of course, I mean, we are happy with any kind of data we can get, and we can certainly get a lot of information out of either the intensity or the velocity data. In the solar case where we have both and where we have exquisite velocity data, those have been the data that have been mainly analyzed. Now, to get on to what we can do with these frequencies, it's obvious what we can do. We can take our favorite stellar model and compute frequencies of that model, and then we can compare those frequencies with the observed frequencies. And then we have an understanding a thing about the oscillation, so that's a good, not very satisfying, really. So a nice way of looking at the properties of these oscillations and extracting some of the information from them is to look at the asymptotic properties, which is really amazingly simple. You can see a single star just behaving more or less as an organ pipe. It's a circular organ pipe, so that has a slight effect on the frequency spectrum. But by and large, what we have are frequencies that are uniformly spaced in the Earth-tone number n. And the fact that the star is vertical comes in as a contribution from L over 2 here, and then there's a correction for what happens to the surface, reflection properties. And then there's more term coming from the next sort of asymptotic description. And this frequency spacing that's in here is just the sound travel time, the integral of, well, not only the sound travel time, the integral of from 0 to r of dr over the sound speeds, sound travel time across the stellar diameter. So it enters in more or less the same way as the sound travel time, but across the organ pipe would enter in the organ pipe frequency equation. And that means that if we have some nodes that we see to the lowest order, just a set of uniformly spaced peaks, we are spaced and given by this large separation, more or less the inverse sound travel time across the diameter. And then that was what we saw in this figure from 1980. This is a more recent set of data, but showing exactly the same thing. We have these uniformly spaced peaks coming in. So that already gives us a measure of how big the star is. Now we know how big the sun is, we don't know how big our stars are. So that is already a useful piece of information about our stars, if we can get this last separation. Second point is that we have this correction term, and this correction term, again from very simple analysis really, comes out to depend on the geometry, on the degree of nodes, and on the gradient of the sound speed in the core of the star, weighted by 1 over r. So this kind of thing is something that's heavily weighted towards the core of the star. Really doesn't depend too much about what happens further out in the star. And the third thing that is that, first of all, if you neglect that term, and you take a mode of making the M and the L, and you decrease L by 1 and increase L by 2, then you have the same frequency. So that is true apart from this correction change. And if you look at this difference between ML and N minus 1 and L plus 2, you get a direct measure of this integral of the sound speed gradient in the quasar. And that again is something we can observe in the solar case very clearly. It's just a chunk of the same spectrum where we have L equals to 0, L equals to 2. So here we have a separation. L equals to 1, L equals to 3. Here we have this smart separation. And so on. So we can measure that, and then we have a measure of the sound speed products in the quasar. And actually, but this is a civilized place with a black bar, so it doesn't matter. I didn't write that on the transparency. The sound speed, well, for gas, it's gamma 1 pressure divided by rho, and approximately ideal gas. You can write that as gamma 1 kb t divided by mu mu, where mu is a non-molecular weight. The non-molecular weight changes as the star grows older because hydrogen is converted into helium. And so the sound speed properties in the core star depends on the composition of the core star, and so it depends on the age of the star. And we can also use that in a diagram like that. If we take these separations, the large separation and the small separation, and we look at stars with different masses, in units of solar mass, 0.7, 0.8, after two solar masses, or in different evolutionary stages, and here characterized by how much hydrogen is left in the core, the initial abundance of hydrogen was 0.7, 0.6, 0.4, 0.2, and 0.05. So these seven curves are evolution tracks in this diagram. And these quantities can be determined observationally, and even with current data, with a precision of, I don't know, 0.1, certainly better than 0.5 microhertz. And that means that from a diagram like that, we can principally point out how old or how evolved, really, and how massive a star is. And that is already information which is very hard to obtain for individual stars in any other way. Now, that was an asymptotic expression for a small frequency separation. So what happens if we actually look at the actual separations between these frequencies? It's a bit hard to read, but this again is the same separation. But now divided by, if I just go back, oops, wrong way, here we are. This is again a fairly trivial geometrical factor coming in. So we can divide by that, and then we just isolate the contribution coming from this sound speed difference in the core star. And what we find in the case of this star, Alpha Cent B, slightly lower mass than the Sun, I'm going to say much more about that in just a moment. If we look at these different values of the degree, this is a slightly different measure of more or less the same thing, we see that it's not quite constant as the asymptotic theory would predict, but it still doesn't depend much on degree. So this scaling with 4L plus 6 or 2L plus 3 really works pretty well. I mean, it's close to being asymptotic. Now, if we set a different star, this happens to be a close neighbor to Alpha Cent B, these are members of a binary system close to the Earth, then we have a different picture. We get a large degree of scattering in this diagram. And the reason for that is that, every first-year mathematics students will tell you have to be careful when you do asymptotic theory, that the conditions for the validity of the asymptotics are satisfied. What we're doing here is basically race theory, so we have to assume that the scale on which the model changes is large compared to the wavelength of the oscillation for the analysis to hold. But if we look in the core of these stars, when Alpha Cent B, and this again is the sound speed in some final units, in Alpha Cent B, that's not too bad. The sound speed is varying fairly slowly, even in the core. For Alpha Cent A, on the other hand, the sound speed is varying extremely drastically in the core. And the reason that every symptom that's here we have used up most of the hydrogen in the core, so there's a strong variation in molecular weights. And so you can't really do asymptotic theory with this kind of behavior. So what we see, do you have a special fan for mobile phones ringing in the middle of talks? Around the beer to the whole audience after the talk? I suggest that. That is quite useful for stuff that kind of behavior. Now, the important caveat is that it shows how we're able to get more information than what is just contained in the asymptotic properties of the oscillations from these measurements. Because after all, just the asymptotic properties give us, they give us interesting information, they give us a mass in the Asian star, but they don't show us what's wrong with the modeling of the star. And really, the goal of every dynamic technique is to prove that my models are shit from these data. And they're doing pretty well in the solar case. Well, I think now the time has come to show it, that the models are not quite good enough for our stars either. There's no way of analyzing these displaying these frequencies. Called the Sierre diagram, and the principle there is that since we have this regular structure to the spectrum modeling, we highlight that by dividing the spectrum up in chunks, each of length delta mu, and then just stack the chunks on top of each other. So we take this chunk, stack on top of that chunk, and so on. So, if you like, mathematically, we reduce the frequencies modulo delta mu, and then plot the reduced frequency like that against the actual frequency. And so what we get from that, well, if the asymptotic theory had been exact, we'd just get vertical lines if we chose delta mu correctly. So here we can begin to see deviations from the simple asymptotic theory in a different way. There's a solar data, the sun again is a fairly benign star, so they look fairly benign. But this we see that there are curvature to these lines which actually contain potentially interesting information, which I'm also going to get back to. All right, so this is the groundwork, the kinds of analysis we can do, and then a little bit about what we have for the sun. These are the data that we have at the moment, or at least about half a year ago, when this diagram was made. So in other cases, this is power plotted against frequency on the same scale, logarithmic of course. And so we have a range of stars with usual star names. And the way these stars have been ordered is from smaller to bigger stars. So the sun is here, we have wonderful data on the sun. These are radial velocity data, essentially. Tau Ceti is a very small, compact star, has a high frequency. Alpha Centauri is fairly compact, higher frequency. And then as the stars become bigger and bigger, more and more evolved, basically, the frequency, the characteristic frequencies decrease up to this guy here, Xeta Hydri, which is a red giant, yellow red giant, which has a radius of, 60 times solar or something like that. It's pretty large. We can work it out from the frequencies, do the inverse analysis. What is interesting here immediately is that if you look at the shape of the power in all these stars, it looks pretty similar. So we have the same kind of excitation mechanism working over a large range of stellar parameters. You can say that in Xeta Hydri we have 5-minute oscillations with periods of around 3 hours. Problem there, of course, is that it takes a lot of patience to observe these oscillations compared with the sun. So for that, you certainly need a grad student who's willing to spend a few months in the mountain observing. Or you need an automated network of telescopes. Given how lazy grad students are becoming these days, maybe we need the latter more and more. So let me talk in some detail about our best case. I should have said a typical case, but this really is the best case we have of solar oscillations in another star. And that is the case of, I should have put a red circle around here. the HSN since the HSN A and the HSN B. HSN is a binary system with a period of about 70 years. It's more or less the closest star to the Sun. It's now star in the same system, it's slightly closer. Which means that we know an awful lot about it, about the system. Because of the binary system, we can measure the masses fairly precisely. We have a distance, we know the velocity. So we have a lot of what I would call classical data about these stars, which we can then use in the analysis of the oscillation frequencies. And they're so very nicely placed on either side of the Sun. FSM A is slightly more massive, and FSM B is slightly less massive. So if I had been given the task of designing the ideal system to look at after the Sun, FSM would more or less be it. So I don't know what that proves. But not very much to me, except that we are incredibly lucky to be where we are.
People in the southern hemisphere
are blessed. Yeah, that's true, of course. You can't see it from here. But, so here's some data. Basically, where are the last measurements of Alpha Sun A? Well, it looks a bit boring, it seems fascinating. The only thing remarkable about this graph is that it's a precisional measurement. The measurement area in each of these points is around 40 centimeters per second. So this is the same star, it's not a very distant star, but it's not the Sun. But it's only the precision that is close to what we can do for the Sun. These were data obtained with the European Sun Observatory Very Large Telescope using the Euler spectrograph, so it's a very, and it's not that easy to get time on an 8-meter telescope to observe a very bright star, but I think it was probably worth it. So we have some wonderful data on this star. So we have a power spectrum, looking for all you know, like solar power spectrum. Again, we observe these oscillations in any objects. We have a problem that the objects tend to rise and set. That's true of the Sun, it's true of stars. And that gives gaps in data, which are a nuisance. So, to overcome that, in this case, we combine data from the VLC and the Anchorage Australian Observatory. So we get an almost continuous, no, not quite continuous, but almost continuous run of data for about a week, and that's the way to do that. Of course, that's also the idea of the ground network. We can do a stacking, and then we can do an averaging of the spectrum, and then we can clearly see the components, n equals 0 and 2, 1 and 3. No, I don't think this is 4, but yeah, it's 4 would probably be, this could be 4, I don't think it is. So we have wonderful data on this star. FSM B, more or less the same quality, even lower mass level. So something lower amplitude also, so, but still we have good data on that. And then we have all the other things we know about the stars from classical observations, masses, temperature, luminosity, radius, from interferometry, composition. And then we can go in and make a match, a fit to the observations. So what we observed are these masses and luminosities, frequencies. What we want to find are better estimates of masses, initial composition, the character of the connection in two stars, the age of the system. Of course, the nice thing about the binary system is that we assume, and of course we could be wrong, but we assume that these two stars were formed at the same time. So they have the same age and they have the same initial composition. So that's a constraint we can impose on the modeling. If the models don't work, then we might have to reconsider, but it's very unlikely that's not the case for this system. And so we fit the data. Yes? Yeah?
What size observed?
Oh, well, that's a comparison, so let's skip that.
Sorry, I asked.
And I can get into that later. So, send your question. The second part, the best fitting models shown here, again in the Hesperian Russell diagram, the illusion tracks. Here are the classical data, and here the triangle, this is a blow-up, shows the best fitting model, both the frequencies and the classical They send here the parameters coming out of that fits, and I swear that this was actually honest to done. I don't believe all digits. I haven't made an error analysis of this number yet. But that's how it came out. And the age again. Chairman, don't trust all the digits. And of course, this is sensitive to uncertainties in physics. But we have recent fits, and then that actually is a good starting point to see what might be wrong with Martin. There's a very interesting aspect with alpha same A. I talked a bit about the convection close to the surface. Of course, stars can also have convection cores. And the borderline between stars without and stars with convection cores is at around 1.1 solar masses, slightly higher than that. So what happens when you look at alpha same A is that if we take the model, this little model, that's the solid curve, and then increase the mass by only a tiny amount. Don't ask me what tiny is, but it's sort of at level 0.001 solar masses. The model develops a convective core and the illusion track looks completely different. It then makes it harder to fit this star because it sort of goes to an edge and then fall down and then you have to go back and you can't linearize, is what I'm saying, around the best fitting model. So that's where Monte Carlo techniques for fitting come in and would be very interesting, actually. Which is something we're working towards. But of course, in terms of characterizing the transition to stars with convective cores, again, it's an extremely lucky star to have. It would be nice to have another one that was there, but can't get everything, it seems, in this world. So if we look at the shell diagram then of this model of alpha same A, the open samples are the model, the closed samples are the observations. And then you sort of begin to wonder whether this is really good enough. And there's certainly some evidence that the small separation from here to here is bigger in the star than in the best fitting model. And similarly, although not quite so clearly for alien 2, 0 and 2. So, what's wrong? We don't know. And offhand, you'd say that this means the star is younger, but if you take a younger model, then the fit would be worse in other aspects. So, this is the best we can do, but there's clearly something wrong that we have not identified. In this,
yeah,
that's right.
What physically would that be telling you?
In principle, yes. I'll actually say a bit about that in just a moment. In this case, I would think it would be random noise, and I would like to see it repeated at least with a different set of observations. Once we're here, it could be any random noise or random effects of rotation coming in, or both together, pulling this. It's a bit hard for you, so I mean, one sort of might wonder, but I wouldn't really put any money on that behavior before I had seen it in our data. And we are seeing our data on African A, African A, so that might come. African B looks very nice. And then you can sort of see this kind of behavior, so could also be a property of the data analysis. But basically here we have a perfect fit. And that's maybe not so surprising because Alpha Centauri B is a very young star, a very underground star, because of its stellar mass. They have the same age, but of course, old stars burn out much more rapidly than smaller mass stars. Massive stars burn out more rapidly than less massive stars. So Alpha Centauri B is far less into its evolution. Right, so this is sort of a brief summary of where we are. Now, let me say more about where we want to go in the last 15 or whatever minutes. Pardon? Oh, yeah. So, what we really want to do is to look into a star and find out more about its internal properties. The kind of things we can look for are, it turns out, with some of these shared features, And again, sharp is sharp in the asymptotic sense, sharp compared to the wavelengths of the oscillation in that region. And it turns out that if you look at the, I didn't define what tau is here, that's bad, but tau again is just MSR of sound travel time, acoustical depths, as we call it. So if we look at the gradient of sound speed with respect to acoustical depths, we find a fairly slow variation, but we have some features here coming from the ionization of helium that affects the adiabatic experiment, and coming from basal convection zone where the structure changes from having a convective adiabatic gradient to having a radiative gradient. So these kinds of features might turn up in the oscillation frequencies. And in certain cases again, we see, for instance, the signature from the basal convection zone very clearly as an oscillation of the frequencies, as a function of frequency. And the principle is basically that what happens to the frequency of a given mode depends on the phase of the eigenfunction at that position where we have a shape feature. So as we change the frequency, we shift the phase of the eigenfunction at the feature, and therefore we shift the effect of that feature on the frequency, and that gives rise to an oscillation in the frequencies. And in many ways that, as a perturbation of frequencies around a smooth variation, and that's characterized by, coming from basal convection zone, by a function of frequency, some phase shift, and you can actually measure these quantities. So that would be nice. We can do it in sound, so can we do it in our stars also? The answer is that we see a signal very clearly in the sun again. And what we really have to get to is what we need to see that signal. How we need to observe the stars to see it, see a signal in our stars. So here is the signal seen in the solar case from Gulf on the solar satellite. And here it's separated into components, rapidly varying coming from basal convection zone, slowly varying coming from the ionization of helium. The sun fits the data very nicely. And you can fit the helium signal separately, and then you can subtract that to get the residuals, and you can actually then get a rapidly oscillating signal. You can do a Fourier transform of that, and then you get a peak in the power spectrum. The location of that peak measures the location of the basal convection zone. So if we measure that in our stars, we can see how deep the outer convection zone is. This is something we, of course, we don't know otherwise. So the same we can do it, what can we do in our stars? And the critical aspect there is how long we observe the stars. So this is the result of an analysis done by Lindwall a couple of years ago. And using different measures, it doesn't matter what they are. But this is a success rate in identifying this feature as a function of how long we observe, in this case, the artificial data. And as you can see, we do very badly unless we observe for several hundred days. So the conclusion from this kind of analysis is that if we want to do better than we're doing at the moment, we need to observe for a very long time. It's not clear that we can't do better than these guys did. I'm not going to go into more details of how they did it, but whatever we do, I'm sure that we have to observe for months to get that kind of detail out of the model. So let's look at other examples. This is the same kind of thing. In this case, analysis done by the Bellman group. Again, this is based on solar data, but analyzing the data in chunks of different lengths. And again, looking for the signature of the behavior near basal convection zone from data sets observed from different lengths, 100 days, 200 days, and you can see the things converge after, again, a few hundred days observing. Same thing for the depth of the convection zone. Same thing from the effect of the helium. And the helium measure is interesting because that's feature that we see coming from helium ionization is a measure of the helium abundance in the envelope of a star. And we don't know how to measure helium in low mass stars. So again, if we observe for long enough, we can actually get a good measure of this. The second thing we can do, and again, let me... Well, we may need to look at... well, let's just look at this. Can we actually, as we've done in the case of sun, do inversions to determine results, properties and structure of the star? In some way, we can get sun speed as a function of depth throughout the star. In all stars, we only have these low-degree modes. But here's an example of what we would get if we had observed stellar frequencies with this kind of internal error, so errors at 0.1 microhertz, a low frequency rising as they do in the sun at higher frequency. And so what is done here is to take two models, one, I think one with a convective mixed core and one without, look at the difference in a quantity, which again I seem to have lost here, but the quantity is simply P over rho. So essentially sound speed. So look at the difference between the two models in this quantity, which has the structure shown by a solid line, and then we simply see how well we can reproduce this structure based on the analysis of frequencies. Doing inverse analysis or whatever, using techniques developed in the solar case. And what we find is that if we have data of this quality, then we can actually get a reasonable measure of this kind of behavior in the inner 20% of stellar radius. Again, these are things we need to investigate more to find out exactly how good the data has to be to give us certain kinds of information. But this, for instance, will tell us about where the core of the star has been mixed or not. And that again would have a big effect on the measurement of the age of star. So from all that, so I've got a wish list that we'd like to see. We have frequency precisions in the order of 0.1 microhertz for any of these kinds of analysis or many others. If we want to see rotational splitting, then we should have an observing length that's several rotation periods. So in solar case, several months. For stars like the sun, several months. So whatever we do, we need to get very long time series. It turns out that the low frequency nodes, sort of at the lower tail of this bump in power, are quite sensitive to many of these features. Basically, because they can be observed very precisely. They have very long lifetimes, and therefore the frequencies can be determined quite precisely. But also, in fact, because the wavelength is longer at low frequency, and therefore sharp features look sharper to a low frequency mode. And so, for instance, the signature of the helium abundance comes through much more clearly in the low frequency modes. And that means that when we observe, we should try not to have too much low frequency noise. We have to reduce the 1RF component of the stellar noise. Now, what are we going to get in the future? Well, actually, we're going to get a French European satellite called Corot, launched in a few months to observe stellar oscillations, look for planets. So that's going to give us really quite long data sets. It has an orbit that allows you to observe one star, a given star for about 5 months. So that is really satisfies many of the constraints that we have on the mission. In intensity, so we have to cope with stellar noise. In 2008, we hope to have the Kepler satellite launched by NASA. If not all the Kepler money goes to things, a very small fraction of the man to the moon. There's always a risk of that in the present program, but who knows. And again, the main purpose of Kepler is to look for extrasolar planets by observing transits in front of the central star. But Kepler is also going to have a program to do astroseismology. The Kepler is going to live in the same field for at least 4 years, so there we're going to get potentially very extended data on the stars we want to look at. And also quite a large number of stars, on the order of several hundred to a thousand stars, observed for astro seismology. We still face with this problem that we have this intrinsic stellar noise. So how do we get around that? And of course, what that does is to basically drown out the low frequency modes. So we need to observe in a way that doesn't have that problem. And that, of course, is why we need the stellar isolation network group. So here comes the messages. So you can switch off or go to a loop or whatever you like. You tend to do when the messages come on the screen. Actually, sometimes I miss these advertisements in the middle of the programs. I mean, when I really need to go, it's a nuisance. That's no natural break. But anyway, that's where we are. The idea is simply to emulate the gong, the Glenn Isolation Network Group, which has been observing solar isolations for 10 years, by having a network of well-placed telescopes to observe stellar isolations. And we claim, of course that has to be proven by a more detailed design, that a 1 meter telescope and an optimized spectrograph stabilized by an iodine cell, we can do it. For stars, multiply stars. But of course, if you want to observe each star for a year and if I retire in 10 years, that should keep the network busy at least until I retire and possibly until many of my colleagues retire. Because there are actually quite a lot of stars that can do that. And because of this, mostly grad students will have to make the operation fully automatic. We don't have that many students either, so we can't staff 8 sites. And we want to place them where our telescopes are ready because then we have the infrastructure. This is sort of an innovation set up where we plan to have several telescopes observing the same star, containing the computer equipment, etc. So we've gone away from that and we're now planning to have a single 1 meter telescope that seems to be as cost efficient as having this master telescope solution. The sizing, well, it has to be such that we can observe both hemispheres more or less continuously in places where the weather is not too bad, so these are sort of at least possible sites. Some of them are more or less given, South Africa and Chile. Hawaii would be extremely nice to have, California or Mexico. This was a dream of our project scientists to put a telescope on Tahiti. Then he looked at the weather forecast and then decided maybe not. So actually, the same thing was difficult, there's too little land there, but we can't do much about that. So that's where we are, and of course, it's wonderful to design a network because it always behaves extremely well. So this is what we predict to see in 30 days on a magnitude 0 star with a network, a spectrum that's as good as any we've seen in solar case. And if we do that for the faint end of the range we want to look at, a 6 magnitude star, we still get quite a decent spectrum in 30 days. And of course, in 4 months, it would be a factor 2 better, or at least. So that would work, at least in theory. And we can then play around with predictions and planning and so on, and we are going to get Kepler. That's wonderful. But in terms of precision of frequencies, which is what this is, the ground-based campaigns are sort of working around 1 microhertz. Kepler is going to get us down to a fraction of microhertz if we observe for long enough. But not for low frequency modes. The sun, of course, will go even lower in precision. And importantly also, we see slightly higher degree modes with intensity. We can only see energy to 0, 1, and 2 with greater velocity. We gain energy to 3, and if you're very optimistic, in a few cases, energy to 4. So the number of modes we're going to have to play with when we investigate the star increases greatly by having the energy to 3 modes also. So you're going to get much higher precision, much more notes, much more information from many fewer stars than with Kepler. And so the way to look at this is that Kepler and CERN would really complement each other. Kepler would give us very decent data on a large number of stars. So we really make a broad survey of stellar properties. But not to precision that allows us really to get detailed information about the CERN properties to a level that we would be able to do with CERN. The status of CERN is that we are these very early days. Well, this just shows that we have lots of stars to look at. We have a logo, which is always a good place to start. And we have a website, which is also not too bad. We don't have any money, or barely any money. We are going to need a lot of, what did I say, yes, it is in per site.
1.5 million.
1.5 million per site, so 8 sites, 12 million, make that 20. Oh, come on, it's nothing. So, I mean, we can talk about that later, but you can get your name on a telescope or on the SAR or an INSEE, like, you're not a Mose.
Buy around
the
beer
or something. That's right, yes. So that's where we are, I mean, in the this design phase. And what we also want to do to get organized is to at least set up a consortium of people interested in the projects. So what is going to happen in the next few weeks is that there should be a newsletter on the website describing the project in slightly more detail and then calling for sign-ups. And you can even sign up without paying for being members of the CERN Science Consortium. And then we'll just have to see how it goes from there. But it will be fine. Somebody have to do something like that someday. Tim, of course, is doing it already. Well, with a little bit of help from Wayne, or the other way around. setting up a network, which is an extremely exciting project, and covers some aspects as this we might end up. We surely collaborate whatever happens. We might end up being subsumed by the LCOGT. Is that what it's called?
That's what it's called.
I got it. I guess I'll learn one day.
I'm thinking the same thing.
By adding instrumentation to the planned telescopes in that network. The advantage would be that network is happening. The disadvantage would be that we won't get access to it for years on end and see the stars. So we'll have to see how that develops. But yes, and certainly one day somebody's going to build it. Anyway, thank you.